Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today, the story behind baseball in Appalachia.
So at one point you had 125,000 people working in West Virginia coal mines. When you see the decline of coal field baseball, not coincidentally, it goes with the decline in employment in coal mining.
And we'll meet some of baseball's biggest fans, people like Lynn Brookshire.
It is the only place that I know of where there's no clock. You just are there, there's a rhythm to the game, and if you don't love the game, you might miss the rhythm.
And Rod Blackstone.
And you're also known as?
The Toast Man, because for 26 years we've been making toast and waving at the bad guys when they strike out, and leading cheers for the home team.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Spring is in the air, and that means baseball's back and players are ready. This week, we're taking another listen to an episode we first aired last fall about the sport and what it means to Appalachians.
Baseball was really a phenomenon, you know, in the early 1900s, like we can't imagine today. I mean, it really was the national pastime, and it was the West Virginia pastime.
That's historian Stan Bumgardner, who's written about the history of baseball in the West Virginia coalfields. He's also a lifelong baseball fan. He says that back during the turn of the 20th century, just as baseball was rising in popularity, coal camp towns also began popping up throughout southern West Virginia. And with them came baseball teams.
You know, in a town of maybe a few hundred people, you might have thousands of people show up because people from the other towns would come in for the game. And it was really a whole day event. It was a social activity.
These games were usually played on Sunday afternoons in coal camp towns, which were essentially towns that sprang up in the middle of the wilderness, entirely built and owned by the coal companies.
You know, people would take picnics and they'd take the whole family, and it was just a huge social activity. And basically the whole town would shut down. There was nothing else going on. The baseball game was happening, so everything kind of stopped for that.
The coal companies sponsored the teams, and they were actually quite competitive, pitting town against town. Coal mine operators could show off their teams while competing against each other.
And you had some very athletic people that worked in the mines, too. That's another thing to point out is that, you know, these were some strong people. I mean, to do the work that coal miners had to do, I mean, they're natural athletes.
Coal companies would even recruit baseball players.
And, you know, assign those people to, you know, less risky jobs, find jobs above ground for them, you know, more office work or less dangerous tasks in the mines. So you literally, coal companies hired certain employees based on whether they were good baseball players.
This arrangement was enticing for good baseball players from the coal fields as the wages for coal miners increased in the 1940s and 50s.
A lot of these really good baseball players could make more money working for a coal company and playing baseball than they could in playing in the minor leagues, playing professional ball.
But the coal camp baseball culture was tied to the coal industry's fortunes.
And the height of Coalfields baseball was at the height of the coalfields. So at one point you had 125,000 people working in West Virginia coal mines. When you see the decline of coalfield baseball, not coincidentally, it goes with the decline in employment in coal mining.
Even as these coal camp teams disappeared, minor leagues were still a big deal in coal country, and in a way, they still are today. Attendance at some minor league games has increased over the past few years in places like North Carolina, Tennessee, and South Carolina. Some teams even set records for attendance. But attendance at the minor league team games in West Virginia's capital city of Charleston isn't growing. It's actually dropped over the past few years. But there are still some diehard baseball fans attending games here in the Mountain State. Anyone who has been to a baseball game knows there are all types of spectators in the crowd. A lot of times, work colleagues and families get together more to spend time together and talk than actually watch the game. And then there are super fans, people who buy season tickets and not only show up to every home game, but they come prepared with signs, props, and a ton of team spirit. Roxy Todd spent a recent evening at Appalachian Power Park in Charleston, West Virginia, recording the voices of some of these ultra-passionate fans.
In between home plate and the pitcher's dugout is what's known as Rowdy Alley. And at this particular minor league stadium, one character is helping it live up to its name.
Super Cal! Super Cal! Super Cal! Super Califragilistic Expialidocious!
This is Rod Blackstone.
The Toast Man. Because for 26 years, we've been making toast and waving at the bad guys when they strike out. And leading cheers for the home team.
There's a mist hanging over the stadium, a smoky haze of, you guessed it, burning toast.
When they started the development of the plans for the ballpark, they put an outlet here for me.
Blackstone has been doing the Toast Man thing before they built this West Virginia Power Stadium. Charleston's former minor league baseball team, the Charleston Wheelers, had a stadium in a different part of town. It was there, in 1990, where the idea for the toast originated.
And at some point, somebody said to a somebody who was struck out for the other team, "You are toast." And so he started chanting at that point, "You are toast, you are toast, you are toast." And then it stuck. So every time somebody struck out, we were saying, "You are toast, you are toast, you are toast." And in 1992, the guy who owned the baseball team said, "Let's make toast at the ballpark," and told me how to plug in a toaster at the old ballpark, make toast, and so we could pass it out and have people wave it whenever the strikeout happened.
For it's one, two, three strikes, you're toast!
And do you buy the bread every time?
Yeah, I actually got some of these loaves at Kroger today for a dollar a loaf, and that makes it fun. And I have a sign that says, "Don't eat the toast, you don't know where it's been," because I do reuse, recycle. So whatever I don't use tonight, I'll bring back tomorrow. But we do have some. It's all about having fun. It's all about engaging people, making it a fun experience in the stands, supporting our home team, cheering for them every at bat, and maybe giving the other team something else to think about so they're not thinking about the next pitch or the next play.
There are a few people here tonight from Blackstone's church.
Can you believe he goes to church? He's very religious.
He's a Sunday school teacher.
The Toast Man even has his own baseball card. A man named Tim Kirkendall comes up with one of the cards to ask Blackstone for his autograph.
My first game ever here.
Then it's time for the second inning. The home team, West Virginia Power, is up to bat.
And right now I have to do a cheer with my friend.
The Toast Man does one cheer with another super fan, 15-year-old Reed Houston.
All right! That is Reed, and he is the number one fan of the West Virginia Power. He'll say hi-ho! We'll say Lolo!
Let's go!
Houston is here tonight with his dad and his grandfather. He comes to as many home games as his dad will take him to. And at every game, he sits right here in Rowdy Alley, cheering for Lolo Sanchez, one of the local stars of the home team.
Hi-ho!
Lolo!
Hi-ho!
Lolo!
Hi-ho!
Lolo, that's it for Reed, the number one fan of the West Virginia Power right there! Cheering for Lolo, one of the hottest hitters in the league.
Next, I go over to sit behind third base, where I meet another group of fans who enjoy a more laid-back, quieter pace to the game.
My name is Lynn Brookshire. I am a huge baseball fan. I used to say I'd spent more hours in the bleachers than I had at work, but then work surpassed that eventually.
Brookshire has been watching baseball since she was a little girl. Her dad played for the Union Carbide team back when companies sponsored their own baseball teams. Over the years, she's adopted several of the minor league players, giving them regular meals as part of a program that began here in 1990. She adopted Trevor Hoffman, who, after playing in West Virginia, went on to play for the major leagues and was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame earlier this summer.
And the young man could eat like nobody ever ate that I ever knew. He could eat like two full fried chickens.
Brookshire says she's had season tickets since 1971.
It is the only place that I know of where there's no clock. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing to be someplace where there's not a clock. You just are there. There's a rhythm to the game. And if you don't love the game, you might miss the rhythm. But there is a rhythm to the game, and it is just like no place else.
And for some people, do you think that's challenging to kind of like, you know, we live minute by minute in our life. We're always checking our phone. And then we come to the baseball and like you say, there's no clock. It's like it could go on for hours. Do you think that's hard for people to let go?
I am certain it is. And that's why attendance is falling off nationally. But, you know, for those of us who can let go for that little bit of time, it's a good thing. And I've got a granddaughter who lives with me. And yesterday she said, I'm not getting on my phone till 5 o'clock today. And at 5 o'clock yesterday, she said, you know, this was a good day because I live on my phone too much. And I don't know what possessed her to do it, but I think that we all are too much in the moment.
As with most home games, Brookshire is here tonight with a group of family and friends who, like her, have been watching baseball in Charleston most of their lives.
Do you have any idea how many games you've been to?
Thousands, yeah, because I was a season ticket holder, too, for many years. My dad used to go. We had our seats we sat at.
This is Greg Wegman. When he was 15, he worked at the old baseball park selling popcorn.
I used to carry the popcorn peanuts around, and my grandfather had pitched there back in the teens when he was a little kid, when it was a wooden park before it burnt. My dad remembered driving past it when the wooden park burnt.
There have been several baseball parks in Charleston over the years and a handful of different teams.
The old park had a lot of history. I don't know if you're aware of it, but Cy Young was at the first lit game there when they had lights, first got electronic lights at the field.
This was in 1931. Cy Young was a baseball legend, and he was there the night that Charleston got a new stadium with electricity that lit up the field for the first time ever. As Wegman, Brookshire, and their friends swap nostalgic stories and baseball memories, the innings pass by us in slow motion. The home team has made some points, but it's a tie at this point. But off here behind third base, which, I'll be honest, is usually where I go when I come to watch baseball, my favorite moment of the entire night is when Lynn Brookshire and her friend Tim Webb tell me the story of a popcorn angel.
One night they came out and dumped all the leftover popcorn.
Yeah, the last game of the homestands, they would always empty out the popcorn machine, and they dumped it out next to the bleachers one night, and they carry it out in a wheelbarrow and just dump it. And we looked down, and there was a kid laying in it making a popcorn angel like you would make a snow angel. So that's a memory that's burned in.
Oh,
yeah,
yes.
I can't erase that one. Yeah.
Covered in butter.
Oh, I'm sure the kid was a mess, but you know, it's the ballpark. You always go home dirty if you're, you know, 8 or 9 years old. Sure.
I love the idea of that popcorn angel kid. And I think he totally got the idea of what baseball is all about. Despite all the toasts being tossed in the air, the cheers and the chants being shouted, the West Virginia Power ends up losing the game that night. But I'm not sure it matters all that much, even to the baseball superfans.
For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're toast!
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston, West Virginia.
Sports do create a sense of camaraderie, and as we'll hear in this next story, players don't necessarily have to be very good to have a good time. In the 1976 film Bad News Bears, a down-and-out and cheap beer-swigging Walter Matthau coaches a group of ragtag little leaguers and tries to whip them into shape.
All right, look alive. Let's get one. Are you ready? Let's get one out there. Engelberg.
What?
That is a bunt. B-U-N-T. The catcher is supposed to pick up the bunt and throw it to first base.
Well, how was I supposed to know? You made sure the big deal yelling after them.
Diversionary tactic, Engelberg. Now get the ball.
Why are you always picking on me? What did I do to you?
Engelberg, crank your crummy belly aching and throw the ball to first base.
If you've watched the film, you may have noticed the Bears' sponsor, Chico's Bail Bonds, displayed on the backs of their uniforms. As a nod to the film, baseball and softball teams around the world have taken on Chico's Bail Bonds as their own team name. And there's even one here in West Virginia. And on that team is our very own Dave Mistich.
Come on, Chico.
You ready?
Oh, trouble.
There you go.
All right.
It's an early August evening on Liberatore Field at White Park in Morgantown. The prison jumpsuit orange Chico's jerseys are impossible to miss, and so is our play. But I don't necessarily mean that as a compliment. On this evening, we lose in typical Chico fashion. There are flashes of defensive greatness in the outfield from Chico veteran Sean Kelly and rookie Dave Lawson. A few Chico's batters turn infield errors into runs, thanks to some heads-up base running. We hold our own against an outmatched and much younger rival, Cheen's Beer Garden, only to crumble when we needed to come through. But all wasn't lost, as it never is with Chico's. The night was still young. Win or lose, we had yet to get to the best part of the Chico game night experience. I found myself a part of this group of gentlemen misfits somewhat by chance, but looking back on it all, it makes perfect sense. It was a Wednesday night in late winter or early spring of 2017. I had popped into 123 Pleasant Street after a long day at work. I sat down, looking for some sort of reprieve from the heaviness that can be my job. I stopped in to say hello to my friend, Tyler Grady.
You said, hey dude, is there like a softball team around here or anything? And I don't remember if I even said anything other than like, come with me, follow me right now.
Grady is a Morgantown musician, car salesman, entrepreneur, and bartender at 123 Pleasant Street.
We walked around the bar and I took you downstairs to the lower bar that was not open at the time. And I stood up on the liquor shelf and I climbed and I got down our trophy that was given to us, the Olivia Newton-John trophy, our 0-23 trophy. And I was like, the greatest softball team of all time is here.
The Olivia Newton-John Trophy is a reference to Tommy John surgery, a procedure baseball pitchers undergo after tearing a tendon in the elbow of their throwing arm. Any baseball fan would surely get the joke. I immediately understood the sense of humor that informed Chico's. I could also tell I didn't necessarily have to be good. This was about goofing off and having fun. But Chico's is an institution with a history far longer than my two-season career platooning at first base. Among the many stories of Chico's lore include a player being picked up from jail to make a game, a player buying an orange Miata and getting a vanity license plate with Chico 84, and strange nicknames like Meatball. With just one season under their belt as the Nyabingi Dance Hall, the team took on the Chico moniker 20 years ago in 1998, the same year that the bar took on the name of its address, 123 Pleasant Street. Morgantown native Louis L.J. Giuliani took over ownership of the bar and sponsorship of Chico's. He says Chico's immediately embodied the open-minded identity of 123.
You know, Chico's, like 123, is certainly, it doesn't matter if you're white or black or straight or gay or whatever. It's all kinds that take the field when Chico's takes the field.
Chico catcher John Vesa, who works in construction and other odd jobs, remembers the early days of 123 the same way.
This bar, especially when it started, it was the bar for everybody that didn't have a bar. Everybody got along. You know, I mean, it was the place for everybody that didn't have a place. And in a lot of what Chico's is kind of like that.
Greg Leatherman is a journalist who now lives in Florida. He was one of the guys who was around when Chico's came together.
It's probably really to do something healthier besides sitting in the dark bar, I think, to go out and do something that was more participatory and less spectator driven and less, because we all sat around and watched baseball together at that time, you know, so it was nice for us to go out and do something a little more, get out in the sun and see the day together.
Giuliani, now retired from the softball field, says Chico's was always rooted in Morgantown's music and art scene.
A lot of the players that they grabbed onto just happened to be musicians. Brian Porterfield. Tom Batchelor. If you are the big tree, we are the small. You've got Jeffy Goodwin, who's a musician, who's playing on the team now. Don't look my way, don't know what you find. a lot of these folks sort of just fit within that framework of softball wasn't their wasn't their first talent, nor their second or third or fourth, but it was a way to bring like-minded folks that like talking about music or art or how many shots of Jameson they had. It was based more on like-mindedness.
Following each Chico game, as it has been since the beginning, the Bonders gather at 123 for cheap beers like Black Label and Pabst Blue Ribbon. And as Giuliani mentioned, celebratory shots of Jameson. For Vesa and other Chicos, the postgame celebration is the perfect cap, with seemingly disparate people milling about, discussing music, sports, politics, and sharing stories of life's misadventures.
More often than not, it is the highlight of the evening, but there's just a certain camaraderie. I mean, I think there's a genuine affection between people. I would like to think that, you know, we love seeing each other when we see each other. I mean, it's a mutual feeling.
Amongst Chicos, Vesa is known for his love of curating the music from the jukebox in the lower bar.
From Beethoven to Bob Wills, from the Rolling Stones to Prince Farai, there's everything on that jukebox. Right. It is an eclectic evening.
Right.
It is awesome.
But even after a few drinks at 123, a Chico's game night isn't over until it's been recapped and shared on the team's Facebook group. Part comedy, part mythology, the game write-ups exaggeratedly highlight the ups and downs over an always hard-fought seven innings. If Chico's doesn't get clobbered into a 10 or 15-run mercy rule before getting through all seven innings, that is. Here's Greg Leatherman.
There's three of us that have kind of done this, and that's myself, David Foreman, and Jim Antonini. And basically, it is sort of like the literary connection to Chico's softball team is that we've always captured the games win, lose, or draw and written up, you know, how the game went in both a serious professional sort of like sportscaster way, but also with a lot of humor.
Shortstop, team manager, Morgantown native, and occupational health science researcher Jim Antonini has taken over the write-ups in recent years.
It's the same story, and it's gotten harder to write them because we continue to lose. And there's only so many ways you can describe a loss and drinking beer after a softball game.
If you were at any given game, you would know what is and isn't absolutely true. If you weren't, well, that's left to your own imagination to decide. Here's Antonini reading from a write-up from a game back in 2011.
The Colasanti left center fielder dashed out of the darkness and fog of the thick, hazy summer night and made a diving, stabbing, tumbling catch, ripping the hearts out of the Chico followers and team members. In disbelief, first baseman Leatherman retreated to his car and wept, not about the loss, but about the pride he felt for his fellow bondsmen. On this night, Chicos were everything that had not been this forgettable season. Daring, hustling, bold, youthful. Not wanting to go home, six or seven Chicos milled aimlessly around the closing 1-2-3 bar at 3 a.m. An exhausted and worn-down Vesa stood over the darkened jukebox, the power long shut off after last call, still trying to make selections, just wanting to hear Peggy Lee sing, "Is That All There Is?" one more time.
If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze.
Chicos finished their 2018 campaign with a record of 3 wins and 25 losses. 2 of those wins came as a result of a no-show forfeit from the opposing team, while the third came on a gloriously executed 7 innings against Davis Cabinetry. Such a pathetic record should make anyone reconsider their motivations to keep playing softball. But if you can't tell, Chicos isn't about winning. Antonini says no matter what happens over the course of a season, it's hard to imagine hanging it up.
I think every year there's a point in the year, probably after you've played 18, 20 games, and it's like, why are we doing this? We come out, and sometimes we really get humiliated. But then the game ends, and then you get together, and everybody has a few beers, and then it doesn't seem that bad. It's a pretty good way to spend a night.
Giuliani, despite not having played in recent years, feels the same.
Chico's is kind of a state of mind in the sense of that, you know, we're not here to judge. you know, we're here to support, and we're here to spend time with each other. And that's the bottom line. We're a softball team that's more of a social club than an actual softball team.
So, if you ever find yourself around 123 Pleasant Street, surrounded by orange softball shirts, you'll know you're hanging out with the Chicos. Buy a few of us a drink and strike up a conversation. After all, we assuredly just got beat. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Dave Mistich in Morgantown.
After the break, we go inside the legendary baseball bat factory, the Louisville Sluggers. And we'll talk with a man who went from living in an isolated timber town in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, to being a professional umpire for the Cincinnati Reds.
Did you ever get hit?
Several times. Several times. That's when you respect good catchers.
Those stories are ahead inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today we're looking at the impact of baseball on people across our region. For our next story, we go a little outside Appalachia to the Kentucky town of Louisville, where for more than 100 years, the most famous and popular baseball bats were made at the Louisville Slugger Factory. The company has been through some changes in recent years, as bigger overseas companies have begun to dominate the baseball bat market. But the Louisville Slugger Factory is still open today, even though a larger company merged with the Kentucky Company in 2015. Back in 2004, Kim Soares produced an audio story about the factory for WFPL. Let's listen back to what co-workers in this baseball bat factory were saying 14 years ago.
The crack of the bat is synonymous with the world of baseball. And for over a century, one name in baseball bats stands above the rest, Louisville Slugger. In a small, tidy factory in downtown Louisville, its legacy is housed and the bats continue to be turned.
Louisville Slugger is blessed in that if you walk into that factory and take a poll about how long folks have worked here, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone under 30 years in terms of their tenure with Louisville Slugger.
My name is Wally Young. Been here 34 years. First thing I'm going to do is rough it out, rough the timber out. So this is called a roughing tool. This just gets it down to close to the size that we're getting. And when I get it down so far with like this, I'll go to a finishing tool. Okay, this is a finishing tool. This is your last tool you use on it when you're turning a pro bat. Makes it smooth. You can tell it don't make as much sound.
We are celebrating our 120th anniversary this year of the very first Louisville Slugger baseball bat. My name is Ann Jewell, and I'm the executive director of Louisville Slugger Museum. Back in 1884, 17-year-old Bud Hillrick, as the legend goes, skipped school one day and went to see the Louisville Eclipse professional baseball team play a game. He was a baseball fan and a player himself, and there was a tremendous hitter for the Louisville Eclipse by the name of Pete Browning. The Old Gladiator was his nickname. And Pete's bat broke during the game. And as we understand it, Bud volunteered to make a new baseball bat for Pete for the next day's game. And sure enough, Pete went, got three hits with the bat the next day, and the orders just kept coming.
All around you, you'll see pallets loaded with long round timbers called billets, most of which will be turned into Louisville Slugger bats. Before arriving here, though, the timber was harvested primarily from northern white ash found in the forests of Upper New York State and Pennsylvania. The billets are then weighed and divided into several grades, with the very best grade reserved for producing professional baseball bats.
Some players want what we call wide grain bats, and some players just, you know, they get whatever we send them. We try to give them all good quality timber. But some of the guys that use our stuff all the time, we're a little bit more particular as to what timber we give them. Now, we try to be particular with all of them, but some like Derek Jeter and Alex Rodriguez and Jeremy Giambi, and them guys like that, we're a little bit more picky about what we send them. Danny Luckett, I started working here in September of 1969. We're working on bats for this year's spring training, and right now we're just, this is called a CNC machine that we're running here, and what it does, I can program the model that I want into it. I just have to load it up, and it just keeps running them until it runs out of timber, and then I start on something else. I think from the time the machine starts to the time it comes back is like 40 seconds.
The Hillerick family set up a carpentry and cooperage shop in Louisville in the 1850s. And Bud was an apprentice in his father's shop. His father was J. Frederick Hillerick. The bats, they moved around to several different places as the business grew and they needed more room. And in fact, there was a while when the bats were actually made over in southern Indiana. The corporate offices have always been, the business offices have always been in Louisville, but there was a little while when the demand was so great for wooden bats that they needed more space and could only find it over there. But then back in 1996, they moved back over to the side of the river, really back where we belong.
At one time, all wood bats were hand-turned, taking anywhere from 15 to 25 minutes per bat.
James Johnson. There's not but about three or four of us on that board up there that can still turn the bat by hand, get it on the hand turn, lay down here in a piece of wood and make a bat. About four of us in this factory left that can still do that.
How long have you worked here?
37 years plus. Well, this is a mechanical machine. This here traces a template back here. And we put the template of the model that we want to run on this bar. And it just follows it, and it's a whole lot faster. This will make a bat in 30 seconds, and it took us about 15 or 20 minutes by hand to make one bat. So this does the work of about 10 men in a day.
It wasn't terribly long ago that you would walk in to the factory and you would have seen just rows of hand turners. As the demand for wooden bats has gone down, and as technology has picked up, the automatic lathes have moved to the forefront, but we will always make sure that we have a number of folks in the factory who can turn by hand. We certainly don't want to lose that tradition.
We don't do it much anymore, but it's fun when you can get back over here and do it every once in a while.
Do you miss making bats by hand?
Yeah.
The quota then was 32 bats in an 8-hour day.
It's not like we've got a new generation of bat makers coming up right now. The folks who are in there have been there for a while. They started very young, and they will be here for a while yet to go. But, you know, if one of them were to retire or a couple were to retire, we would definitely make sure that the process and the art, really, of turning a bat by hand is known by a certain number of them. They do train on it. We would definitely make sure that there were others coming up who would know how to do it.
That story originally aired in 2004. Wilson Sporting Goods bought the Louisville Slugger Company back in 2015. We reached out to find out if the merger has impacted employment. According to Rick Poff, Director of Human Resources with Louisville Slugger, the company is making more bats now than they've ever made. They currently employ 227 people, about 40 fewer jobs than before the merge. 57 of those jobs are at the factory itself. In baseball, the one on the field who holds the most power is often the umpire. They're also the one who takes the most heat when fans or players don't like a play they call. But none of this bothers Virgil Broughton. He worked as a baseball umpire for 38 years, working Little League games, high school and college baseball, and eventually the minor and major leagues. He's retired now and lives in his hometown of Elkins, West Virginia. Roxy Todd met up with Broughton to find out what it takes to make a good umpire.
To be a successful umpire, you gotta live the life, clean living, and know the rule book up and down, and try to treat the spectators and the ballplayers with respect.
Virgil Broughton spent the first few years of his life up on the logging camp town of Spruce in Pocahontas County. Back then, he says he didn't even know what baseball was.
We didn't even have a radio. The only thing you had to do up there, you either go fishing or hunting.
But then his family moved to the town of Elkins, where baseball was a big deal.
I was 10, 11, 12 years old, and I played for a local Pepsi-Cola bottling company. And
what do you mean you played for it? Like the Pepsi-Cola bottling company sponsored the team?
That's right. They sponsored a team, and I was their catcher. And I reckon that's how I ended up umpiring. I love being behind the plate because I always said I want to be where the action is.
Then, after high school, he joined the military and was stationed in Germany. He became a catcher for one of the Army baseball teams and got to travel throughout Europe.
I liked it because it got me away from the Army base, and I met new friends.
One day, the umpire didn't show up, so Broughton volunteered.
But I fell in love with umpiring baseball, and I traveled a lot, and I made extra money.
That stint in the Army led to an umpire career that stretched almost four decades. After the service, he worked high school and college baseball. Eventually, he got a contract to umpire for the Cincinnati Reds.
Did you ever get hit?
Several times. Several times. That's when you respect good catchers. I'm very fortunate. I got the umpire behind Joe Ferguson, which was an All-American from the L.A. Dodgers, and Johnny Bench. He was a catcher for Cincinnati when I went into professional ball. When you have guys like that, they protect you. You better keep a good relation for them because they could accidentally let one go by and put you down on your back.
His favorite part of the job was meeting famous players. But the hardest thing was being away from his family.
The minor leagues is rough on umpires and ball players because in the minor leagues you get a schedule every 2 weeks for the following 2 weeks.
His schedule bounced him around all over the Southeast, in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Alabama. Broughton says this was on purpose, to make sure that umpires don't stay in any one town too long or get attached to a particular team, so they'll be more objective when they make their calls. His wife stayed back in Elkins, raising four kids on her own for 8 months of the year. The only times they got to see each other was when she came to one of his games.
She drove from here to Asheville, North Carolina, to see me work a ball game on a Friday night with the four kids in the car, no interstates, just drive straight down. And the next day, I was in Mobile, Alabama, next day, which meant I left that night to go to Mobile. And Sunday, I was back in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Then when he was in the major leagues, it became even tougher to see his family.
In pro ball, I never did umpire with another married man. They was either divorced or had never got married.
One tip Broughton has for any umpires who do have family who come to one of their games, never walk into the stadium together. He learned that his wife couldn't even sit near him or talk to him during the games, or else one of the disgruntled fans might take it out on her. If you're going to be an umpire, Broughton says, you have to have thick skin. Thick like a Pocahontas County bear he remembers encountering.
That old bear was thick skin. He survived that cold country.
The bear story goes like this. Broughton's dad worked on the railroads, hauling coal and timber up in the cold, high-altitude town of Spruce. One day, they hit a giant bear with the train. When they went back to get it to divide it up for meat, they discovered the bear's skin remained mostly intact, even after being run over by the train.
That bear, the hide was so thick and so tough and so strong. All those engines and coal cars ran over that bear, they never did cut it in two. And now that's how that old bear survived Cheap Mountain all those winters.
And that's how Broughton was, as an umpire, too. Tough as that old bear that survived on Spruce. Still, working the big leagues for only a few years was enough. Broughton decided to return to West Virginia.
That was a rough life, being away from home, and I had two young boys here playing little league, and I was bouncing around over the country, and I wasn't a happy camper with that, so I packed it in after about 4 years and come back home.
After 38 years as an umpire, he opened a sporting goods store in Elkins. The store is still open today, and two of his sons run it now. He says he's happier back home, though he does still miss being close to the action, right behind home plate. So every now and then, he umpires for local Little League games, where he says he still gets flack from some of the most intense fans, parents. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Elkins.
Now, for our final story, we'll hear about one of baseball's most peculiar plays. It took place in 1987 in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. It was a variation of the age-old hidden ball trick, except it involved not a hidden baseball, but a hidden potato. That's right. Producer Dan Collison spoke with the man responsible for the play and two people who witnessed it.
It was a really strange night. We had a good crowd. I mean, it was one of those really boiling nights where at any moment things are going to explode. So you had this kind of haze over the ballpark, this old ballpark. The dog days of August, this was the dog day of August.
My name is Dave Bresnahan. In 1987, I was a Class AA player with the Cleveland Indians organization. My position was catcher, and the team name was Williamsport Bills of the AA Eastern League. We were scheduled to have a doubleheader, which I chose that day because I knew I would catch one game of the doubleheader. And it was twilight, which was actually kind of a perfect setting. When I saw my name in the lineup in the first game, you know, I had brought three or four peeled potatoes to the game. And in the locker room, we were, you know, throwing the potatoes around. So it wasn't a big secret within the team.
I'm Rick Muntean, and in 1987, I was the assistant general manager of the Williamsport Bills. I was cooking hamburgers down the right field line. Great view of the plate.
My name is Lou Hunsinger, Jr. On August 31st, 1987, I was sitting in a third base grandstands. I can't recall exactly what inning it was. I know that there was a Reading Philly runner on third base. There was a batter up for them. And the runner on third base took his normal lead.
There was a moment there right before the play that was, you know, part of baseball, but now looking back on it was the trigger. Dave stood up, called timeout, said there was something wrong with his mitt.
In the dugout was a spare catcher's glove, and in the glove was the peeled potato. So I had to turn to the umpire, and I remember his name, it was Scott Potter. He did make it as a big league umpire for a few years. And I turned to Potter and said, "Hey, Scott, you know, my glove's broke. I need to get another one." He goes, "Sure, go ahead." So I trot over to the dugout, and in my bag is that spare glove with the peeled potato in it, and all my teammates are all kind of laughing, can't believe I'm going to do it. So as I ran back to the home plate area, I had the peeled potato in my glove as I gave the sign, and I had to make sure that the hitter didn't hit the baseball. So I called for a slider low and away, and just before the pitch was thrown, I moved it from my glove hand over to my bare hand and caught the slider, and then came up, took the potato, and threw it over the third baseman's head.
Pressing the hand cocks and throws, and the object flies into left field, which I thought was a baseball, and everybody else did too, and so did the runner, and he then continued down to home.
Here he comes, running towards home, and I thought, oh my God, it's working. So I just wanted to be patient, wait for the runner to, just before he touched home plate, I tagged him.
Now the best part of it all was Bresnahan standing at the plate laughing. He was laughing at home plate as the runner was Rick Lundblade, and he came down the third base line, and as he got to the plate, Bresnahan just all of a sudden was standing there laughing and tagged him out, and the umpire, Scott Potter, originally said out, called him out.
There was confusion. The fans were confused. It looked like the umpire was confused. The runner most certainly was confused. The only one that wasn't confused was Bresnahan, because he'd known what he had done.
And I showed the umpire the ball, rolled it up on the mound, and told all my teammates to come, you know, off the field and into the dugout, but they were all laughing.
And I saw our left fielder, Miguel Roman, pick up the potato, which I didn't know was a potato. He picked up the potato, and the look on his face, I think, kind of stunned everybody because he didn't do anything with it. He just picked it up, looked at it, and just looked back at the infield.
The third base coach for the Phillies, he sees what it is, and he starts laughing. And then the third base umpire, who's from New York, and he retrieves the largest piece, and he walks back towards the home plate umpire, and he yells out, "It's a freaking potato!"
And all of a sudden, somebody brought the potato into the infield. And Bresnahan, of course, said, "Yeah, I peeled a potato, whatever."
Despite some reports, I didn't get kicked out of the game. The umpire just ruled the runner safe, and then we got the next hitter out. And as I went back to the dugout, my manager didn't seem to be real pleased. He pinched it for me, took me out of the game. So that was it, and I was glad the team won, and I thought that would be the end of it. And it wasn't. It sure wasn't.
The word got around immediately, and our phone did not stop ringing off the hook about, "This guy's a bum. I hope he's gone. Get him out of town." All that stuff. You have to know Williamsport. Williamsport, the birthplace of Little League Baseball. They take it seriously over there.
As sort of a semi-baseball purist, I was appalled by what I perceived to be a Bush League stunt. I didn't like it one bit when it happened.
I didn't really anticipate anything. I woke up the next morning and got a phone call from our trainer saying that Orlando wanted to see me in his office. I knew it wasn't good news, so I took a cab and went to the clubhouse, and Orlando told me that, you know, they're going to release me.
So I was there when he came back to clean out his locker. Well, he walked in, put a potato in every locker. And he walks into the manager's office and counted out 50, put 50 right on the desk, and he put a note on the potatoes. It said, "Dear Orlando, sure you don't expect me to pay the $50 fine now that I've been released. Instead, here's 50 potatoes. This spud's for you, Dave Bresnahan." And he tacked it on one of the potatoes. And at that moment, he became my all-time hero when he did that.
And so when I read that, I really started chuckling about it. And I thought, well, maybe this isn't so bad. You know, like I said, it took a couple days for me to realize that probably this is part of the essence of what, you know, the fun and good heartedness that our national game is supposed to represent.
Then it all started. Then it all, the world cracked open for Dave Bresnahan at that point. I can't read off or remember all of the people that he was on, but I know he was on the baseball game of the week. He was on Paul Harvey.
"Hello, Americans. This is Paul Harvey."
And my phone was ringing off the hook. Papers from L.A. to New York were calling me, and radio stations were calling me across the country.
When he was on Paul Harvey, that did it for Williamsport. Now he was their hero. Naturally, everybody in town was there that night, and it was great. I loved it. It was great. So it was pretty neat how the reaction changed. But it was Paul Harvey. They heard him on Paul Harvey. The word got around town. I mean, this guy's pretty neat, and it's national news, and we're on the map now and all this stuff.
In May of the following year, they decided to do a Dave Bresnahan night, retire my number, and make, you know, a big promotional event.
When we announced that we were going to retire the potato thrower's number, then it went wild. It was the largest crowd in Williamsport history.
If people brought potatoes to the game, a potato, they could get in for a dollar, and of course the food we donated to the local food bank.
And the box office, when we closed, was filled to the top with potatoes. Women were coming over, pulling their tops down, having them autograph their breasts.
My speech went something like this, where, you know, Lou Gehrig had to hit 350 and hit over 400 home runs to get his number retired. All I had to do was hit 149 and throw a potato to get mine retired. And I don't think the baseball gods are looking down on me and shaming me for that at all.
I had no idea that there was an infamous baseball play involving a potato during a game played in Pennsylvania, in an Appalachian county, no less. What is the most unusual or striking? Get it? Striking? Okay, no, really. What's the most striking thing you've ever witnessed at a baseball game? Do you have memories of going to watch minor league teams in your community? Or maybe your grandparents or great-grandparents used to play for Cole Camp teams. Share your baseball story. Send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or send a tweet. We are at In Appalachia. We're also on Instagram. Our handle there is WVPublic. Baseball, or more like wiffle ball, I guess it was, for me, was during a simpler, much slower time in life. Like the Cole Camps, my family mostly played on Sunday afternoons. In my grandparents' front yard, we used the squares on opposite ends of the sidewalk my papa had poured as first and third bases. The white concrete sidewalk led from the bottom of a flight of steps at the front of my grandparents' house over to the soggy, grassy ditch on the edge of the highway where the passing lane just started, beyond the blind curve. Such fun memories as a kid playing with my cousins, siblings, and family. I don't play much these days, just as we don't have family Sunday suppers anymore. Nah, Sundays for me as a parent mean catching up on laundry, cleaning, or meal prepping for the week, but it doesn't mean I don't miss it. We've desperately tried to renew these traditions in my family, but haven't succeeded yet. There's one more thought about baseball I'd like to share from historian Stan Bumgardner on the significance baseball once had for so many people in the coalfields.
We're in such a fast-paced world now, and we expect everything to just move quickly and fast-paced sports. And things were a little more laid back. You know, today it just seems like, you know, there's a rush even in baseball to get through the game. You know, when that was the big event of the week, you know, people didn't care how long the game went. In fact, it was great if it went to extra innings. You got more time to hang out with your friends and have your picnic. And it was just a great social time.
Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, the Hillbilly Gypsies, Spencer Elliott, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He and Glennis Board edited this show. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at In Appalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. Don't forget to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter on our website. If you'd like to listen to any of this episode again, you could subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.